Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240 for spring semester 2026. Today, financial markets and institutions. As I had told you, I plan to have a surprise quiz for you on Thursday. So be surprised. It is in the Respondus Lockdown browser. If you're still having problems, there are a few people still having problems with Chrome. Come to my office. I'll be there tomorrow most of the day, so you can stop. Well, I'll be there in the morning, definitely, and a little later in the afternoon after classes. But come in if you're having problems getting that practice quiz done, just to make sure that you can do it and get that out of the way. But other than that, you should be able to get the quiz. It's just a sort of a passing quiz. It's all multiple choice and true and false and fill in the blank. There's no math on it. And I do about, I think the one tomorrow or on Thursday is, or yeah, Wednesday, is 20 minutes. And so we do that at the end of the class. And when you're finished with the quiz, you're free to go for the day. Before anything else, and I will start SquareCap on Wednesday. I've sent you a link directly so that if you have not gotten an invitation or have not filled it out, click on that link and it'll take you in there. Fill out a registration with your ISU email address, and then it'll show you where to get into your course. And then you can download the app for your phone as well. I'll look at the numbers today. Now, this is a little bit of a mixed story, and we're having it's sort of everywhere right now. There are some market participants who are bullish, still bullish, and then there are is a very worried class of investors who are generally bullish, who are now getting very worried about the market. But it's causing volatility to some extent. As you can see right here, the volatility measure is VIX. And notice that it is in the green. So that means that there's uncertainty in the markets. That's risk, and that translates generally into lower stock prices. Risk does. And so if you look at that, the VIX is flagging more risk, more volatility. And as you look at the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, they're both down. Interestingly, though, the Dow 30 is up a little bit. Now, that's in one way, that's strange, because the Dow should be going in the same direction as the others. But in another way, it's not so strange, because we're talking about these vast companies in the Dow. They're just the giants of the earth, these oligopolies, and they really don't have much of a worry about what's happening that would be impacting companies that are of more normal size. Even very large companies like the S&P 500 are vulnerable to economic bad times, and definitely the NASDAQ is. So they could be showing negative, bearish sentiment overall, while the Dow is just sitting there saying, well, what's the problem here? We're going to survive regardless of what happens to the rest of the economy. But going over here, just to walk you around the world, I try to do that every day so that you get this sense of not just a market called the United States, but we talk about markets all over the world. And in Asia, again, that was what happened last night here. We were in the middle of the night when they were in the middle of the day over there. You can see that the Nikkei showed a bad day. Notice that it actually started out a little tiny bit positive, and then it just slid through the day. More and more bad news piling up. It wasn't terrible news, but it was enough to just keep pushing the market down. The market wants to just stay at one place, But when information comes in, it is assessed as good or bad, and that moves the market up or down. And in this case, the market just kept getting bad news through the day about the Japanese economy. And so the market, it slid almost 0.75%. And the same, oh, we can go over here to the Hang Seng, whereas, notice this is an odd one. Well, not really odd. The market opened on a drop, just dropped through the floor. But then that was all there was to it. The rest of the day, there was no more information. So the so the Hang Seng just floated at that lower level. It had had an acceleration pushing it downward. And then that just, once that was gone, it just stayed right there. It doesn't bounce back up. It stays at whatever level the last piece of information gave, put it at. And it was down pretty severely, almost 2% down. So that's not so good. But Australia, same thing. Again, part of the more or less the Asian market, even though it's more of a European type of country, it's still in the Asian theater region. So there you go. It's down too. Not much, 0.33%, but that's still enough to get us to notice it. That negative sentiment, as the sun was setting in Asia, it was rising in Europe, and that bearish sentiment seems to have carried itself over to Europe. The CAC 40, again, that's Paris. That's the exchange in Paris. 40 big, huge companies, you know, Revlon and all those kinds of companies over there. And it was pushed downward. It was actually almost trying to come back to level where it started, but where it closed yesterday, but then it just started dropping and it got all that out of its system, and then it just sort of stayed there for the rest of the trading day. And the Euronext, a composite of stocks from around the European bourses, that's exchanges, they were down, not horribly, but still down. Definitely all that red is telling you bearish sentiment around Europe. And you got the DAX was down. Notice how the DAX behaved very similarly to the CAC. So in other words, this is Paris, this is Berlin, and they were close enough, and their economies are closely related because they're both in the European Union. So they are reacting in a very similar fashion. Their patterns are very similar. See that? They have that same look to them. And Euronext had the same look too. A broader composite of European stocks. And then we come over to London, which is not Europe. London is not part of Europe. It's not part of the European Union or anything like that. After Brexit, it broke off. So it has its own pattern, and its pattern was rather bullish. Although it seems to have, you notice how even it actually had the same kind of overall look as the CAC and DAX. But it was all to the positive side, and it finished up. Actually, is London? No, London's done for the day now. So it was up a little bit. So good news. However, we come over here to the United States, and there it is. The Dow, as you can see, it was positive, choppy but positive through the day, and then the S&P 500 tried to do the recover. But it didn't, and it's been falling off. What time is it? Yeah, it's okay. It's still not closed, so there's still a little trading left. But see how here it looks like the bears are in control in the final hour of trading right now. And you see the NASDAQ is doing the same thing. It's blipping downward here at the end. So they're all these two are both down. The S&P 500, nothing, not really terrible, just negative 0.21%. The NASDAQ is a little more significantly down, between 0.5% and 0.75%. So it's one of those things. Let me mention something here. The Russell 2000. I generally tend to ignore that one because the Russell is sort of like this hodgepodge of just several thousand stocks. It's an index, and they just take stocks and put them into it. So it doesn't have a theme to it. And it's not a weighted portfolio. In other words, weighted averages, weighted indexes, the bigger the company, the more it affects the index. With these ones like the Russell, it is not a weighted index. So it's just sort of a tiny company dropping can have as much impact as a large company stock dropping. So it tends to be one that, yeah, we can look at it, but it's not really telling us much of interest to us if we're looking for broad economic activity. Now, commodities. Gold, notice the gold bugs, and I don't know why. I was asking around a few hours ago why gold spiked. Speculators came in, they bought a lot of gold, and then they started selling it off. Once it peaked right here, and then they just started selling it for some reason. And it's kind of difficult to know because speculators, they have their own network of communication, their own mentality, sort of like groupthink. And in this case, something spooked them for a while today, and gold shot up, and then it dropped back down. However, overall, gold is now coming up on about $4,700 an ounce. The best information that I get from traders, or commodity traders right now, is that by the end of this semester, we'll see $5,000 an ounce again. We saw it last semester in the spring. It got up there above $5,000 an ounce, and that was really scary. Remember that flight to quality from stocks to bonds, bonds to gold? Well, it got up there, and now the sentiment is that even though we had a, you know, kind of an up and down day, gold is on its way back up, and probably sometime traders are telling me look for sometime in October or November, it'll break back through $5,000 an ounce, and that's really bad. That's bad news. Generally speaking, that's a real strong indicator that there's a second stage flight to quality underway. As far as that goes, just making a note of it, crude and overall crude and light sweet Brent, light sweet, are both on their way upward, and they're not really anything big. If you see Brent get to $100 a barrel, if you see crude at about 92 to 95 a barrel, that's when the price of gasoline is going to get back up there to the $5, $4.99, $5.19 range. Right now, it's being a pussycat compared to what it might be in the next couple of weeks if the war in Iran, in the Middle East, heats back up as some expect it to do. Generally, the expectation is now that it's all a lot of saber rattling. There's not going to be a re-escalation, but there are also traders that are saying, yeah, there is. And so there is some pressure upward on the price. Not strong pressure, but it's there. Here's the one to keep your eye on. 10-year bond. As you recall last week, that was about where it was, 4.70%. That is a strong, that's high. That's scary high. Here's the dynamic, and this is something that will be important as this course goes along, for you to walk through this chain of logic of how the markets work. And I'm not going to test you on it for a while yet, but I want you to walk with me through it, and I'll try to do this as often as I can. The first thing is the bond prices and yields are inverse. So as the price of bonds goes up, their yields fall. As the price of bonds goes down, their yields rise. Okay, that's the first thing. You've got to keep that little oddity in mind. So what happened, what's going on right now is that we are at $40 trillion in national debt. And that, and it's actually to the point now where we're paying probably about $1 trillion just in interest on what the government has borrowed. The government's paying about $1 trillion in interest on $40 trillion in debt. Take that as your starting point. Okay, now, the federal government is borrowing hand over fist. Why is it doing this? Because it is on, it's spending on huge programs, military programs primarily, and it is, even though it's cutting social safety net programs, the vast majority of funds are going more and more and more dollars to things like the military right now. So we're running these, and we, on the revenue side, with the lack of tax revenues coming in from corporations, that is causing us to have lower revenues. So we are borrowing hand over fist to pay the for the government to pay its bills. Okay, now how do you get out of a trap like that? Well, the first thing is we get to say, well, it's your problem. You guys, you're going to be the ones who have to deal with this down the road. But right now it's getting to the point where that interest is just too huge to ignore and kick down the road. So what the U.S. Treasury did last week, there were two things, and I won't go into one of them because it's kind of complicated. But what it did was the government, the Treasury, bought back a whole bunch of its own government bonds. It bought them back. Essentially, it paid in the open market, it paid the price to buy its bonds back. That way it doesn't have to pay interest on them. Well, in order to do that, where would they get the money to pay it back? Well, what they'll do is they'll borrow that money. And you're saying, no, wait a minute. They're going to buy back debt and pay for that debt with more debt. Yes. The theory of it being that if you buy huge numbers of bonds, you buy bonds, that creates demand. Increased demand increases the price of bonds, which brings down the yields on the bonds. That's the idea. They were actually buying the debt to cause the price of the bonds to rise, which would push the yield on those bonds down. That is what usually happens. That's economics. It didn't work. Do you notice that price right there, that yield, is still where it was last week? It's the same yield. Or, it's, as a matter of fact, it's even worse. So that's the first question. What the hell happened there? The government buys back an enormous number of government bonds and refis them, and there was a problem. It had to refi them, so it issued debt right away to refinance the debt, and that caused the price of the bonds to go back down as the supply increased of new debt. Supply increased. When the supply goes increases, price goes down, yield goes up. So it was a wash. It didn't work. And then, worse yet, is that now, how did they buy some of those bonds back? They printed money. And when you print money, if it's too much money, it will just ignite more inflation. So the ultimate result is going to be that the yields go up because they had the government had to borrow to buy the bonds back, and the price and the yields will go up even more as inflation begins to soak into those yields. Big mess. Big, huge mess. It was a bad idea, it kind of theoretically, but the idea is going to work because what will happen is we'll have a lot more inflation within about 6 to 9 months, and that will erode the value of that $40 trillion just because inflation eats away at the value of long-term investments. If you understood a piece of what I said there, you're in good shape. You're fine for right now. And we'll get into it more, and I'll keep saying it long before I test you on it. I'll make sure that I've said it enough times for it to soak in. But anyway, there you are. Sector map. It's actually kind of bullish bearish. The big, huge technology sector is in bear territory today. Industrials, healthcare, even energy is in bear territory. So we do have a few that are looking a little bit brighter, but geez, it's certainly not a bullish day by any means. And on net, this is a definitely, no question about it, this is a bear day. I'm going to take you on a journey through a couple of some stocks here. Companies, corporations, Wall Street is watching, traders all over the world are watching what a company says about itself. That's information. Now, one of the big pieces of information that we all want to see is what a company's earnings are for the quarter. Now, we've passed the second quarter. We passed second quarter. And so we're having earnings coming out for the quarter. Companies issue their earnings. However, before they issue the earnings, they issue what they think those earnings will be. They're going to issue an earnings estimate. And so that gives the investment world some idea. Did they earn a lot of money? Did they earn only a little bit of money? Or did they lose money? And so the first piece of information is the earnings estimate. And so traders act on that estimate. And then the company actually issues its earnings. And that then, of course, the traders are able to compare what the company said to what actually finally happened. So take a look at a few companies that are issuing their earnings this week. With one of them, Marvel Technologies. Yes, that's the Marvel universe and all that kind of stuff. They're issuing on the 27th. Now, this is pre-market activity here. Let me look over the past, let's say, 1 month. Now, you notice that it appears that when the company issued its earnings estimate, that was a very, they were saying, we're going to do good. Our earnings per share is going to be strong. But notice this slide off, less and less happy sentiment as traders began to suspect that maybe that will be an overestimate. They will not hit their earnings target. So you begin to get, first you get this, wow, they're saying they're going to do really well, earnings per share. And then you get more and more bearish bears saying, I don't think they're going to hit that target at all. And so you see it kind of peeling downward. Now, just a few days from now, will be when the company says what actually happened. So the traders right now are, everyone is buying and selling on rumors, and the rumors are always just thick out there. Right now, I've heard rumors Marvel's going to come in with a strong earnings report because of the movies and other stuff that they do. And then there are those who say they can't be doing that well. And so you do have some negative rumors, but it's still dominated by positive rumors. Let me look at the last 5 days here real quick. Yeah. See how this actually is sort of what I was hearing. There were all these, this is going to be a good earnings report. And then some big, very influential people in the investment world started saying, I don't think so. And that made it just kind of drop off. And it hasn't really recovered since then over the past 5 days. So we're just going to have to sit and wait for the actual earnings report to come out. It's just one of those waiting games. We wait and see what's going to go on. Another one that has earnings coming out, I think it's either tomorrow or maybe it's Thursday or Friday, NVIDIA. Oh, look at that. Dropped off the face of the earth early this morning. Just went kaboom. Right. Interestingly, see here, this is the actual opening bell right here. And the bulls were in charge. They were pushing upward on the price. But then, something happened, and kaboom, it dropped like a rock right through there. So apparently, notice how this information just came in, dropped the stock, and then the stocks just kind of bounced from there all day long. If I look over here at the 5-day, just to have a better look at it, it's just been skidding all along. There's a lot of sentiment that NVIDIA is not going to come in with good earnings report at all. So it's just, and right here, this was this morning right here. This is 5 days. This was this morning, just dropped off the face of the earth. I mean, that's just kaboom right there. Now, another one. Who else is doing this? I know one. Intuit. QuickBooks, TurboTax, all of that. Is Intuit even traded? Intuit, come on. Intuit, yeah, there it is. Look at this. It's real, see how choppy that is? Really choppy. But do you see this spike? Rumors are that it's going to have a good earnings report. Rumors, that's just the rumors. If you look at the 5 day here, where the heck is 5 day? Yeah, see this? See how the rumors really just, it's going to be positive. It's going to be good. And so now it's just good rumors, positive rumors just are coming in that it's going to be a strong earnings report. That's one of the things that you want to keep an eye on. When you are trading stocks, look at when earnings are going to be reported. Trading is more interesting and sometimes more profitable when you are approaching an earnings date, when earnings are going to be posted. You look at what the company has been estimated maybe a few weeks before to a month before, the company's going to give its estimate. And then you assess for yourself. Is that estimate going to be reasonable? Is it too modest? Or is it too aggressive? And then you can find that that is when the most trading happens on a stock. And there's the most chance for something you to make some money or to lose money. There's an old rule that's been around for decades since I was early in my trading experience. Buy on the rumor, sell on the news. In other words, if the rumors are positive, the stock price is going to go up on that information. Okay, let's say that it was good earnings. Well, on the date the earnings are actually reported, that information has already gone into the price. So you sell there. So you're buying on the rumors, on rumors of a good earnings report. But if they're true, well, you might as well just get out of the stock because the rumors have already, that has already come into the price. And also, suppose the rumors are too good and the price is going to, and the earnings per share is going to be not very attractive. Well, you might as well get out of there before the report comes out that morning. That way that the price, you'll have benefited from the price appreciation, but you got out before the truth of the matter showed up in the morning news. So that's an old rule. Buy on the rumor, sell on the news. And sometimes I'll even put that as sort of a question on a quiz or an exam. Buy on the blank, sell on the blank as an old trading rule. Okay, just one more. I want to show you something else. And I may have already shown you this, but there's always, in a grim world, and this can be a grim world, there's always conflict somewhere in the world. And that means that the companies, the corporations that are involved in the conflicts are going to profit from them. There's no question about that. That war is good business for companies that are in the business of war. And there's always somewhere a war happening. So those companies are always going to be reliable. So one of those, and I may have already shown you this, LMT, Lockheed Martin, massive military industrial complex, And this is a stock that is always going to be reliable for what it can deliver to you. Notice the beta. Now, you remember what betas tell you. They tell you the risk. One and above is very risky. Below one, one and above means more risk than the market. Below one means less risk than the market. Notice that Lockheed Martin is an extraordinarily low risk investment. Do you see that? 0.11. I mean, it goes, that's nearly riskless. Remember, a riskless investment is one with a beta of 0.00. This thing is virtually a guarantee. That's what I was talking about. War is always going to be with us, and this is how you profit from war, is by taking on companies that are involved in that business because they are a safe bet. That's exactly what you're seeing here. Lockheed Martin builds war machines, and that's always going to be there. They're never going to run out of business, so they're doing fine. And over a long period of time, if you were to look at this over 5 years, notice that it seems to pop during major conflicts and then it settles down. But notice that it's on the rise again in this era right now, which means that the market is assessing that the market down the road for the goods and services provided by these companies is on the upswing as the world heats up just in time for you to be of draft age. That's just something to always keep in mind, is just like basic consumer products like shampoo and toilet paper and bar soap and all those kinds of nice things, we always need those, so those have low betas. And here in this sector, we always need war material, war engines and war supplements. And so these are another one of those basics of human existence, most unfortunately. Just something to keep in mind. Enough of that. Let me take you on a walk today. The thing here is that I brought this up before, but it's a launching pad for what I'm going to do for the rest of this lecture and part of the next. Financial intermediation. Now, I will tell you that the book goes into this, but it doesn't go into it in as much detail as I do. And I'm not talking about tons of detail. I'm talking about three pieces to financial information. I would like, sir, for you to meet with me because you said you needed some money. We meet at Starbucks and you say, I need $100. And I say, oh, I can't do that. I have money in my pocket, but I don't have that much money. So I am a surplus economic unit, and you are a deficit economic unit. Surplus economic unit, and you are a deficit economic unit. I have money, you need money. But the problem here is that one of the, we're trying to match. Trying to spell here. We're trying to find a match. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units. But in this case, a financial intermediation did not work because there was a difference that we could not overcome. That was the amount, or more formally, the level. That's a fancy word for the amount. I have money, you need money. Well, that's the start of it, but we fall apart right off the bat because there's not enough. So I said, come back to me next month. So you come back in, and we sit down, and I said, okay, I've got the $100. Okay, we're in business. And I said, okay, well, when are you going to pay me back? And you say, next year. I say, well, screw that. I'm not giving up $100 for a year to you. So it didn't work because in this case, the level was okay, but the timing of the transaction was not there. So the level was the first step. The timing would have to be the second step. So we meet again, and I say, okay, look, I guess I could do without $100 for a year. We're good. And you say, wow, okay, well, I got to get back to my job. And I say, what's your job? I'm a race car driver. You're a what? Yeah, it's life and death every day. Oh, hell no, you're not getting $100 from me because that $100 might be in your pocket when your car bursts into flame on the racetrack. Nope, not going to do it. There is the third piece, the risk. So financial intermediation is successful only if level, timing, and risk are all three achieved. Now, that sounds complicated, but actually it's not, you see, because different classes of surplus economic units have different combinations of these, and so do the deficit economic units. So, for example, let me give you an example of that. Corporations, oftentimes, very large, creditworthy corporations, often will want to borrow money, but only for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days or 270 days. This is called commercial paper. It's very short-term debt. And they go out into the markets to acquire. So, for example, a Microsoft might say, we need $50 million for 30 days. And, well, there are a lot of large-scale investors who would say, no, I don't want to give up for just 30 days. I want to get rid of this money for longer than that. I want investments that are long-term. But there are investors who definitely do want to lend money for very short periods of time. That it's a vast market on the level of $1 trillion is in that market on any given day. It's a lot of those kind. Where do they come from? Oftentimes corporations will have money, but they will have it, they want to make money off it. But they have to pay bills maybe in a month or two. So what they want to do is have that money that's in their bank account work for them for, just a couple of weeks to maybe a month or two. And then they want it back so that they can pay their bills with it. This is a very common practice. As a matter of fact, I teach a whole course in this code that talks about where these companies can unload their money for very short periods of time. So there is a market out there for very short-term loans. There are those who have those loans. There are those who want those loans. And commercial paper is the big place where that companies issue the commercial paper. And then, in other words, they're borrowing the money. And then they pay it back in 30 days or 60 days or whatever, as I said. On the other hand, there are companies that don't want their money back for a long, long time. They want to lend it, and they don't want to see that money again for years and years. In fact, there's one vast ocean of surplus economic units with just hundreds of billions to trillions of dollars. well, who would want to give up money for 40 years, 50 years, 30 years? Here's the thing. Madam, you know that you're going to die someday, right? You do know that. You're ignoring me. Yeah, you know you're going to die. But you're not going to die right now. Probably not tomorrow. You're going to live to be probably about 100 years old. Yeah, you will. And most unfortunately, you'll be really bitchy in your last years, but I can tell that about you. No. Here's the thing, though, is you buy life insurance. You pay life insurance premiums every month. Many, many, many people have life insurance. They pay insurance premiums every month for this life insurance. Well, I, as the insurer, actuarially, I know that I will probably not have to pay a death benefit for you, to your grieving loved ones for 50 years, 70 years. So in other words, all that money is piling up in these insurance companies just looking for a place for a long-term investment. And so for as far as long-term investments go, insurance companies are one of those places that has tons of funds that they can lend out to anyone. They lend out for 30-year bonds, 50-year bonds, even 100-year bonds. So in other words, the money is borrowed, but it's not paid back for decades, many decades. And then there's the ones in the middle. There's just all kinds of constituencies that need money for different amounts of time. And there are constituencies that have money to lend or to invest for long periods of time. So on both sides, there in financial intermediation is how those funds are matched up, borrowers and sellers. So for example, you, sir, want a car. And so I'm a lender. I would have to be the kind of lender who makes car loans. In other words, loans for anywhere from 3 to 7 years. That's my, and obviously the level, I've got the money, the timing, 3 to 7 years, I can do that. And the risk, as long as your credit score is good, we're going to work with you on this. So that would be sort of like a middle area. Now there are other financial institutions, maybe the same ones, that make mortgage loans. 20, 25, 30-year mortgage loans. So that's another constituency. People need money for 30 years to buy a house, and there are banks and other lending institutions that have funds that they want to unload for 20, 25, 30 years. So this is a complex system, and it's almost mind-boggling when you get into the details of who is in what parts of this market and all that. The ones who lend money very short-term, companies that have money to lend out for a few weeks, is a very different market from the types of lenders who are going to go longer-term. Let me think here. Okay. That's financial intermediation. I'm not going to beat it to death, but it's the kind of thing I could ask a question. Okay, choose the three of these that are the pillars of a successful financial intermediation, something along that line. It's not going to be any in-depth stuff, but I will point out some of the different kinds. So, for example, commercial paper would be a very short-term kind of debt. Car loans, home loans, those would be long-term types of debt, intermediate to long-term. Something I'll do right here, just so I don't ever forget it. In the world of debt, we use three different, we distinguish duration, as it were, by three different names. There is debt that is short term, and we call that debt bills. There's debt that, and this would be anywhere up to 1 year. So in other words, commercial paper would be a bill. Now you have bills all the time. Well, I got a bill in the mail for my electric. No, you didn't. You actually issued a bill and you were asking an electric company to accumulate a debt on you for 1 month, very short term. And then it sends you a memorandum reminding you that you issued a bill that is now coming due. So it's kind of a different way of thinking about it than the average person. But you are the issuer of that bill. The government issues very short-term securities, less than a year. They're called treasury bills. They're borrowing money for less than a year, and then they pay it back. The next kind is called the note. Now, this one is a little bit dodgy because we used to say a note was anywhere from 1 year to seven. And then you started hearing 1 year to 10, and they even called a Netflix issue that was 15 years a note, which seems stretching it a lot, but I'll put it between 1 year to, I'll just put 10 years right here. Although this seems to be a little fluid these days at 10 years. Like I said, we used to say to 7 years and then it stretched to 10. And now I see 15 year paper going out and getting called notes. And then there is the classic bond. Definitely more than 20 years, more than or equal to 20 years. So in other words, when you borrow to buy a house, you are actually issuing a bond. It's a special kind of bond. It's a mortgage bond. In other words, it's backed by an asset. But it's no question, you are issuing. You want to buy your dream home is a double wide trailer on the outskirts of Decatur. Yes, you're living the dream. I make fun of Decatur and I shouldn't, you know. Because my mom's from Decatur. Yeah, I know, I met her at a truck stop. But, you know, nothing like, the point here is that it's your dream home. $50,000 and you come to me, the banker, I want to borrow $50,000 to buy my dream double wide trailer. Double wide because your kids are double wide, okay? Too much McDonald's. So here's the thing, I say, okay, you are issuing me a bond. I am going to buy that bond from you for $50,000 on these terms. I am the investor. The lender is the buyer of the bond. The lender is the investor. You are the seller of the bond. You are the issuer of the bond. That's very different from what most people think in everyday life. Well, you know, I got a mortgage. Well, actually, you issued a mortgage document. Well, I didn't issue it. They had the paperwork. No, but they're saying you sign it so that you can say it's really yours. So you are issuing the bond. The bank is buying the bond for the face value of the loan. The bank is investing in the bond. Now, a car loan is the same thing, but it's a note. Okay, I want to buy a $40,000 car, an SUV, nice one. Okay, you go to the bank. You are proposing to the bank that it purchase from you, that it invests $40,000. That's what's going on actually in legal terms. You're the issuer as a borrower. You're the issuer. You're the seller. The lender is the buyer. The lender is the investor. I wanted to get that out on the table now. It's kind of complicated. Now, say you come to me for a loan for $100 and you're going to pay me back next month. You are proposing to me that I purchase from you a promissory bill for $100. It's a bill because it's less than a year in length. You're selling me a piece of paper, and for that piece of paper, I am paying $100. I'm investing $100 in you. Now, again, this is kind of topsy-turvy from how most people would think about debt, but that's how it actually works. But let me talk about, just briefly here, about different kinds of markets. First of all, a market is, most people think of a market as a place where you go and buy stuff at the store or at a community farmers market or something like that. A market is a much broader term. It's any place that exchanges occur between suppliers and demanders of goods and services. Any place where exchanges are made. It can be physical or it can be virtual. And I'm going to put an S on here because there are different types of markets. There is, and I did this one earlier, there are financial markets and there are virtual markets. Or, I'm sorry, not virtual, I mean physical markets. Commodities, things that there's a tangible intrinsic value. Understand that financial markets, what's traded in there does not have any intrinsic value whatsoever. Nothing has any value. Another kind of market we could talk about is stocks versus bonds. These are equity markets. They are debt. This is debt. When you buy a stock, you become an owner of the company. You have the right to whatever is left after the debt holders have been paid. So this is a residual cash flows claim. This is a prior cash flows claim. They're quite different, actually. The bond market is very large. Maybe 6 to 8 times the size of the stock market. It is a market that is generally less risk because you get paid first out of the company's revenues and all that. This is more speculative. This is technically a forever security. You may not hold it forever, but that stock is out there forever. Even if the company buys it back, it's still there. It's just called treasury stock at that point. This is forever. This is for a period of time. Bonds, they mature in a year, 5 years, 15, 20, 30, 50, whatever. Very different, those are two very different kinds of markets. Now here's one, the primary versus the secondary market. The primary market is where a company sells its stock to raise equity in the company. You will never participate in a primary market. Secondary market is what I show you every day here, where traders have the stock, they want to sell it, other traders want the stock, so they buy it. The primary market, a company like Facebook, wants to raise $1.2 billion. That is transacted in the primary market. You don't buy stock in an IPO or in a seasoned offering. You don't. You're not. That's not your market. These beasts called investment banks are where that stock is sold. The investment bank says, okay, you're going to issue $1.2 billion worth of stock. We will buy it, our investment banking syndicate. They'll allocate, they'll get a bunch of investment banks together, and each will buy a block of the stock. That's where the stock is actually sold by the company. Once that happens, then the investment banks that participated in the syndicate, they sell it to their great, to their big, usually oftentimes to their best clients. And so at that point, then they'll hype the stock, they'll pump it, they'll make all these press releases, all these financial journalists will come to their little confabs and listen to this this great story of this IPO. And once they pump the stock up enough, then on behalf of their very wealthy, powerful clients or themselves, they'll sell it to you and me in the secondary market. That's where we buy. I bought in an IPO. No, you didn't. You certainly did not. You bought in the secondary market. Anytime the company doesn't get any money from you, it's already gotten its money from the investment bankers. It's already got its funds. The rest of it is just you and me and maybe some others. They buy and sell it from each other. That's all that trading activity, millions of shares a day that I show you, bids and asks and all that. That's secondary market activity. Now, a crucial term here, the difference between money and capital. Money is short-term funds, less than a year. Any funds where the transaction is occurring within the cabin of 1 year, that's money. So in other words, that commercial paper, that whole market is a money market. You can probably, a lot of people have a brokerage account, and so they'll put money into the account so they can buy stocks. Well, while that money is parked there, they will probably be putting that into money market securities for you short term, because you're probably going to want it back to buy something. Capital is this long term for projects. Now, stocks and actual bonds, that those are transactions that happen in capital markets because those are long term. Stocks are forever. Bonds are things that are more than 20 years long. So those would be capital market transactions. So in other words, a company that is issuing stock is accessing a capital market. A company that borrows on 30-year bonds is accessing a capital market. When the government borrows money on a T-bill, something less than a year, it's accessing money market. If it's issuing its 2, 5, 7, 10, 30, whatever, then it's accessing capital markets. Those are generally different markets. Short-term investors are a very different kind of animal than long-term investors. A short-term investor is not interested in not having his or her money for years and years. Short-term investors, money market investors, they're okay with maybe a day, 30 days, 60 days, but they do not want to have that money away from them for any more than a year. So those are very different. Now, the last one that I want to bring up here is spot versus forward markets. A forward market is actually a kind of derivative. And the book goes into derivatives in part of chapter 2. I won't test you on derivatives. However, I will want you to know about one type of derivative called a forward contract. Here's how it works. And I'll give you an example from my years in the oil and gas industry in Texas. We would go out into the oil patch, punch holes in the ground, find nothing, punch holes, And every once in a while, we'd get something. Now, it wasn't anything spectacular. It's not like those old movies where oil spewing up into the sky and all of this kind of stuff. It was just punch, and then this awful, stinky, hot sludge comes out of the ground. It wasn't quite sludge, but it was thick and hot and smelly. It was sour crude. Okay, that's fine. Okay, we would pull that once we got the a hit, then we get everything hooked up and get the pump jack and get these big, huge reserve tanks. Ours weren't that big, but they were pretty big. And then once a week, a Cocaline truck would come around. And there were two ways that we could sell that oil. One was we could take whatever the prevailing price of oil was for that grade on that day. And even back in that time, they had these little machines that would tell them what they would buy it for at spot. Or you could make arrangements for a price that you would get every time the driver came out for a period of a month, 6 months, whatever it was. And I don't remember exactly. That's a forward price because it's a price for delivery in the future at some point down the line. A forward price is an agreed upon price that will be paid for delivery in a future down the road somewhere. So when you go to a gas station, you buy at spot. Whatever the price is, you pay that. That's spot. But there are places where you are engaged in forward contracts. Like, for example, you get your first high-paying job. They're going to tell you your salary for the next year. So in other words, you are negotiating a forward price for your services for a year. Forward contracts are extraordinarily common. I mean, probably in the worlds in which I have dealt in commodities, forward prices are always there. So, for example, let me show you this. I don't know. I've got to pick on this. You, sir, you are a coffee roaster in Chicago. You buy beans from South America and Central America, and then you bring them up, you roast them, and then you serve these fresh coffees at your little shops all over Chicago. Okay, well, you've been buying at spot, whatever the price of coffee is, but then you call me up, and I am a coffee plantation owner in let's say, Nicaragua, okay, or Guatemala. You say, I'll tell you what, can we make a deal that you will deliver to me 5,000 pounds of roast, of beans ready to be roasted in 6 months? I say, well, that's cool. That's cool. Let's say that spot right now is $4 per pound. Okay. Well, let's say that we negotiate 6 months from now, 5,000 pounds at, and we agree for $4.05 per pound. That's a forward price. I will deliver to you 5,000 pounds in 6 months, and we are already agreed that it will be at $4.05 a pound. Now, let's take a couple of different scenarios. Suppose that right at 6 months, the spot price is $4.20 per pound. That spot in 6 months. Well, I have to deliver to you at that price we agreed on, $4.05 a pound. So you win and I lose. You follow that? Suppose, on the other hand, the spot is $3.95 per pound. So in this case, you have to pay me 405, but you could have bought it at 395 on the spot market. So in that case, you lose and I win. That's how forward contracts work. However, in both of these cases, see here, I, the seller, could have made 420 for 5,000 pounds, but I've agreed to take 405. So it looks like I lost. But I really didn't, because clear back here, I knew what I was going to get 6 months, what I was going to get 6 months in the future. In other words, there was no question 6 months ago, when I'm sitting here, I know exactly what my revenue will be. That's gold. I have a perfect crystal ball. I know that in 6 months, I will get $4.05 times $5,000. I already know it. On the other hand, suppose that the spot is $3.95. Well, in this case, well, yeah, you could have bought it at spot for $3.95. But 6 months ago, back here, you already knew a cost 6 months in the future. You knew exactly what it was. No estimate, no guessing, no volatility of the market. You have locked in a cost. That is why this is actually favorable to both parties, regardless of whichever party wins or loses on forward versus spot. We both know exactly what's going to happen in 6 months. Revenue and costs are determined 6 months in the future, which is absolutely golden, because then we have taken away price volatility as a risk factor in our business. So that's why forward markets are so huge. Almost anything that is going to be delivered at some time in the future, There's going to be a forward contract made on that. Yeah. Yeah, at the time of delivery. Now, once in a while, and I talk about this in a class that I have in derivatives. Now, once in a while, you'll have an earnest money kind of put with some third party, just to make sure that, you know, everyone's serious here, that we're going to put some blood into the game at the beginning. Yeah, so that's a good question right there. But in general, these forward contracts for hundreds of thousands of bushels of wheat, other grains like corn, and in fact, there is a market which is highly, highly structured. See, these are custom contracts, and they are very typical. However, there is a form of this contract where everything from the delivery date to the amount, it's all set in stone by a contract called a futures. The futures markets are nothing but highly structured forward markets. But forward markets are very common, and we deal in forward markets all the time. But we also deal in spot markets. When you go to the grocery store, you're buying at spot. When you go to get your gas, you're buying at spot, and all that kind of stuff. However, in other places, like your salary, like your payments on a loan, those are forward prices because they are going to occur in the future at some point. Okay, that's enough for today. I thank you for being here.